Welcome to the Audio Spells production of Journeys of the Astral Path's Michael. I'm Robin, and we are ecstatic to bring you this show. Please help us grow by subscribing, 5-star reviews, liking, sharing, and commenting wherever you enjoy your podcasts. For more information and our full credits, please visit www.theastralpaths.com or search Journeys of the Astral Paths on Facebook. And now, let us cast you a spell.
Now that was sleep. I'm curious why I seem to be dreaming so much since starting this audio journal. I mean, does reliving our memories create passages into extravagant dreams? Perhaps. I'll pop in on some psychology classes at Marlowe's University and ask the question, because my dreams feel so vivid, I struggle to be sure if I'm awake when I do come out of them. So now, back to the day I moved to Chicago. It's crazy to think all these things happened in that first day. Despite being an eventful one, I can honestly say days this crazy are sort of the norm when you can be anywhere you want to in seconds. Probably why remembering this and putting it on tape is becoming rather addictive. So I'd seen Officer Sanchez's photo, and this was more than enough incentive to read the story. I read, "Officer Sanchez of the DPD reported suspicious activity around the abandoned house shortly after midnight. On further inspection, she found the front door had been forced and was slightly ajar. At this time, she called for backup and waited for responding units to assist her in the search of the house. In an inner bedroom, they discovered 4 middle-aged Hispanic men who had been murdered with 1 bullet to the forehead, execution style. Most notably, the bodies were at different degrees of decay, indicating that their times of death were within weeks of each other." There was a lot more. I mean, this was pretty big news for Denver, but I was just shocked that my coffee date had been caught up in such a high-profile case. I pulled my phone out and sent her a text. "Saw your big news in the paper. Do I say congratulations?" I sent it and waited momentarily for a reply. It occurred to me she was probably pretty busy, and I put it out of my mind and flipped to the sports to read about the Nuggets' race to the top of the Western Conference and how the Broncos were thinking of starting a rookie quarterback for the remainder of the year to build for the future. Honestly, I'm not a big sports follower, but since it was that or reading about politics, I chose sports. I didn't have to peruse the sports too long, as only a half an hour or so passed before Marlowe came up from the safe room. "Well, Michael," he greeted, "did you rejuvenate with some Qigong?" It hadn't even occurred to me. "No." He was in a bit of a rush. "Well, you see, I've been meeting with some friends. As I mentioned to you, things with Clarence have deteriorated." "The Whistler," I said. "Yes, the Whistler of your favorite tune, Clair de Lune. Rather apropos, considering he has become a full-on lunatic," he said, and sat down next to me. "Seems a lot of crazy is going on around. Remember that cop I had my coffee date with?" I asked him. "Of course, your famous first reading." I folded the paper back in place so he could see the news. "It appears she's a police celebrity." Marlowe looked closely at the paper, reading the entire article at a glance. "Now that is odd. Anomalous, indeed." "Coincidence, I guess." He frowned. "Certainly your involvement in this is coincidence. However, hers may not be. What do you mean? She's a cop. She discovered a disturbance, and then she went through a door and found some dead bad guys. The article said gang-related deaths. He sighed and corrected me. The article said one victim possibly had ties to Mexican gangs, but the other three had pretty pedestrian and lawful bios. But Michael, we don't exactly have time to discuss this right now. I need your help on a rather urgent matter. Ah, yes, the Whistler. How could I help? Your tailor didn't even leave me a knife, I said. Why would he? You haven't been trained how to use it yet. Knives cut both ways, my friend, and at this point you'd be a little assistance in confronting Clarence. Having said that, you are perfect for drawing him out. He paused, and I thought about what that meant. You want to use me for bait. He shrugged his bony shoulders, but then nodded, yes. But let me explain. I'm going to jump ahead in your lessons, way ahead actually, to dueling. You see, generations ago, when astropaths had conflicts, they fought with knives, because swords are too damn heavy. When we astral project, anything we take with us draws from our energy. Our clothing, anything in our clothing, and a small blade for someone who can project themselves at a rapid pace is far more useful than an unwieldy sword anyway. He rose, his hand stopping me from asking the question I had in my mind. Guns. Yes, they have been tried. Small handguns. But they are, again, heavier. And bullets add to that. And how many you bring add to that. And trust me, they are little match for an astropath who is flashing all around you or departing altogether to another room to avoid your bullets. So, shorter blades have become our weapon of choice. I see. Okay, and I have no skills, I admitted. Not yet. But let me also explain a lesson I would have saved for combat and survival against our own. If you are wounded in any way while projecting outside your body, you need only to concentrate on returning to your body, and you'll arrive safe and sound. I've been shot, stabbed. A Doberman pincher once leaped up and bit me in the neck. I was seconds from the end on that one. But if you can picture your body and return before you die outside your body, you will recover. Again, your energy is drastically drained by injuries while traveling. A near-death injury can lay you up for days. But you'll be okay, and the wound won't exist in your actual body. Huh. It's like a video game, I surmised. He scratched at his chin. Similar in many ways, I guess. However, let me explain the other outcome. A sudden death outside your body is a loss of life, and there is no returning to your actual body. Some people speculate you roam the spirit world or... Yeah, who cares? Speculation is futile. But your actual body will die. It will pass from the coma state it is in when you travel, into cardiac arrest, and finally death. If this is a pep talk, you're really shit at it, Marlo. It's real talk. And sadly, I'm going to bait Clarence to come out after you, and, reluctantly, I'm going to take his head off. Killing him instantly, because we'll never find where his body is. So this is what I need to do, because last night he killed an astropath in Taiwan, his third in as many months, and there is no other way. What if I draw him out and you lose? He looked at me seriously. You run, but I am bringing help, the best knife fighter I know, Ray Mendoza, a Filipino astropath trained in the art of Kali by his grandfather. He will assist in this matter. When it's done, he will also train you, as he trained me many years ago. The talking was done. I had never been a particularly brave man, but I guess this mission felt like self-defense. He'd come after me already, and he'd come again if they didn't stop him. We walked back down to the safe room, laid back. I rotated my head to look into Marlowe's eyes. And we arrived in an alley that was pulsating with the glow of lights from a long brick warehouse where hard bass and strobing, pulsating light leaked out like a beacon calling partygoers. "We're in Prague, in the Czech Republic," Marlowe said, looking around. "Keep your eyes open." A few patrons were using the alley for a smoke, but they hadn't noticed our entrance as we had arrived near the back and darkest part of the alley. "There she is," Marlowe said, looking at a couple talking near the mouth of the alley. "Come along." We approached them, and as we drew near, I thought they looked an odd pair. The girl was in her mid-20s, maybe a year or two younger than me. She was pretty, with shoulder-length brown hair, vibrant brown eyes. Her companion, who had his right hand behind his back as if he was about to draw the blade that was there, was a thick-chested man of at least 50, with scraggly, rust-colored eyebrows and dull green eyes. He was a few inches shorter than her and had nowhere near enough genetic similarities to be family. "Connor, she's safe." "It's me," Marlowe greeted. "Marlowe, and who is this?"
"Michael, and this is Connor, and his student, Agata."
"Agata misses her friends. We train in Ireland." "We're meeting her university friends tonight," Connor said. "Connor, she's a spark thrower, and Clarence has sensed her here on several occasions. Please take her home. Michael and I will take your place. It's time I deal with him." Connor thought only for a second. "Good luck, Marlowe. That English bastard won't be an easy one to handle, even for you." He turned to his student. She and I were looking at each other in an awkward moment of circumstantial unity, like two strangers on a flight being rocked with turbulence. "Come along, Agata. This is not going to be a pretty fight." They flashed away. "What now?" I ask.
"Now we wait for Ray," Marlowe replied.
But he no sooner had finished the name and Ray stepped from the shadows. Ray, in his late 30s, confident stride and chiseled features, demonstrated a disciplined fighter. His calm and confident demeanor put me mildly at ease. "So now," Marlowe continued, nodding to his friend, "we wait for Clarence. Ray, this is Michael." We shook hands, his iron grip expressing what I'd expected.
"Our plan?" Ray asked simply.
Michael walks right through the club, front doors to the back doors, exits, and I'm guessing he'll have a tail," Marlowe surmised.
"I'll be at the back," Ray said.
"I'll be right behind you as you walk through the club," Marlowe continued. Just before I made it to the front doors, guarded by three guys the size of small mountains, Marlowe thrust some cash into my hand. "Here, use this. Now don't worry. He won't do anything in the club. He's been very deliberate to do his deeds in private." I guess I should have asked this question earlier, but it was a few strides from the doors that I ask, "Why is he killing astropaths?" He's killing newly awakened astropaths because he fears there are special, more powerful astropaths coming. He fears only the ones he doesn't know. He's so paranoid about the future generation, he's tracking anyone who has ever taught, and he's trying to eliminate any of their students and them if they get in the way. I stopped us by pulling on his arm. "So why hasn't anything been done before?" "A year ago, he was all talk. Paranoid ranting is far from a crime." The music was amazing. I just kept thinking how beautiful the girls at this club were and how awesome the music was and how I'd give just about anything to be there for the purpose of a great night out
instead of working as a worm on a hook. The warehouse rave-style club was not as large inside as it seemed outside. It was packed, shoulder to shoulder, from the front doors to the DJ stand at the far end. There were tall, standing tables in the corners, but most of the club was open space for dancing or standing. I made my way to the bar. I needed a drink, but assuming nobody would speak English and considering no one could hear anything in this place anyway, I just pointed at a beer and gave the bartender far too much money. He smiled broadly, nodded a thanks, and I took the beer and kept moving. A couple of short-skirted, tall model types were dancing together, and out of habit, I tried to brush through them to see if either was interested. I had forgotten about my ability to read their thoughts and know for sure. I was so scared, I wasn't thinking clearly. I guess this is when habits take over, when our norms dictate our moves. The tallest of the two had a dynamic smile, and she was already fully laughing at me for my effort. Her friend, however, a blonde with a necklace of glowing red beads, used her index finger to call me back to them. She whispered in my ear, "American." I'm not sure if it was a question or an insult or a compliment. "Yep," I said, nodding. They both giggled, and then looking over their shoulders, I could see Marlo. He was looking around, painstakingly alert. I knew this was not the time for anything else, and that I needed to do my job and get out of here. I held my beer up to them in a toast. They both held their drink glasses up, and we touched them ceremoniously. They took sips, and I tossed the entire bottle back in one drink. Then I walked on. I had to come check this place out sometime soon. Maybe I'd meet that astropath girl, Agata. Man, she was a looker, and it might be nice to have a kindred spirit my age. The DJ booth was set above the dance floor like a rock on a shore. The waves of dancers lapped at it, their arms undulating and their hair illuminated in the flashing lights made me feel as if the entire building was afloat. To the right of the booth, in the far corner, there was a hallway that led to toilets and to the back exit. I slithered through the hallway, jammed with a mob of women waiting on the bathroom and a few guys waiting as well. I stepped outside with a couple guys who had decided to forego the lines and pee in the back alley. Both had cigarettes they set to flame, and between that and a tiny high bulb from a streetlight, that was about all the light there was. I didn't see Ray. I acted as if I was also heading to pee, and one of them, a head taller than me, but as skinny as a post, noticed me. "You too, yeah, those lines are too long for me." His English was remarkable. Did everyone know I was American? Of course, I didn't need to pee, and they certainly did. They were full stream and go in seconds. But I was just fiddling with my pants to act the part. They finished and headed back in, leaving me alone in the back alley. I was trying to adjust my eyes to the dim light, but before I could, I heard it. I could hear him, but I couldn't see him. Then the whistling stopped. "You'll never rule me, spark thrower," Clarence growled, and at the instant I felt a shove and fell to my knees. The clang of metal on metal was shrill in my ears. To my left, Ray and Clarence were locked in a blade-to-blade struggle. Then I saw Marlo flash behind him and swipe at Clarence's neck. Clarence was surprised, but still he was able to roll his head forward a half an inch, probably no more. And Marlo's decapitation failed. Marlo's blade cut deep. Clarence, gushing blood from his wound, vanished, leaving Marlo and Ray facing each other. "Did you get him?" I asked. Ray reached his hand down and lifted me to my feet. "No, he was too quick. And now he knows we're coming for him," Marlo added. "Sorry, Michael. It would appear we must remain on full alert.